Grass-finished beef, for example, in general has 300% more riboflavin than grain-finished beef, than feedlot-finished beef. Well, what's the importance of riboflavin? Well, riboflavin is the calming essential fatty acid. It's what keeps you emotionally balanced.
So we're here with someone who needed no introduction. It's Joel Salatin. Welcome to the show. One of Colin's heroes. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
So Joel, you got a new book. I've read a few of your other books though. This one seems a little different. So can you just kind of start with that?
Well, sure. It starts out being different because it's co-authored.
Right.
And my partner in crime is Dr. Sina McCullough, who is a PhD chemist nutritionist kind of person, who actually at about 31 or 32 was planning her funeral due to just acute autoimmune diseases and stuff. She couldn't even get up off the floor. And she just had this kind of epiphany that she decided, you know, I'm going to quit depending on doctors and depending on everybody else, and I'm going to fix me. And so she used her PhD status to research and changed her diet, changed her life, changed her attitude. And now she's a vibrant Energizer Bunny, 41-year-old that is just coaching people into health. And so we actually did a presentation together. We never met. And I was completely captivated by what she was saying. She was captivated by what I was saying. And we found ourselves in the crowd after the presentation. She said, let's do a book together. And so I said, yeah, why not? And so this has never been done. So it's done as a conversation, a dialogue between a farmer and a nutritionist PhD. And so she brings that part of it, the nutrition side, the chemistry side to it. And I bring, well, what does that look like down on the farm? So we've been able to connect this whole, you know, from literally from the soil to the plate in a continuum for people to bring them to a place of ultimate health. We call it maximum health, wherever they are. If they're starting at a Sheetz gas station or at a health food store or wherever it is, there's no judgment. Everybody starts from someplace. And so we coach you to health.
Yeah, we had her on the show. It was actually a very awesome conversation. It got cut off every 15 minutes and she hopped right back on, but it was still a fun show. And her story is really fascinating. And so our audience will probably listen to her before this. So that will be a good follow-up. You've been at this health thing for a while though, because you've been, you know, at first it was like farming, and then obviously you made a connection between like growing real foods, farming, health, all these things. You've been writing books about it. You know, you've been writing books about the legality of the farming business. There's just so many different rabbit holes to go down. With this book, what's like the primary message you're just trying to get out to people? Because I, you know, there's a lot out there and people are overwhelmed with information, you know?
Sure. Well, I think the primary message, I mean, obviously the title is Beyond Labels. And so the primary message is to go beyond labels, to pull that curtain back, if you will, and empower people to feel confident of the food decisions that they make. If all you know about your food is what's written on the label, you probably don't know very much about it. Labels are profoundly misleading. They do a lot of clever speak, and there are a lot of things that you would expect, you know, from a label that you don't see, things that you see that you think they mean one thing and sometimes, right, and they often mean something else. And essentially the government ain't got your back. And so we need to have our backs. And so the idea of the book is to bring us to a place of confidence in our food decisions.
Yeah. So let's take us back real quick. You've been doing this thing for a long time. I mean, how long have you been farming and writing and kind of promoting these ideas?
Oh, well, you know, I mean, I grew up here. I was 4 years old when we came. I had my first chickens when I was 10. And so if we start from there, you know, it's over half a century that I've been farming, growing something.
So you've been watching this evolution of kind of, you know, like small local farms supplying their communities to big agribusiness and whatever. I mean, is that part of what's kind of inspired you to want to speak up and to, you know, help promote change? I mean, you just watch this happen right in front of your eyes for the most part.
Well, yeah, through my lifetime, I mean, I can remember when there was no Tyson. I can remember.
Oh, wow.
I can remember when Smithfield, well, of course, that hadn't been long ago. Smithfield was owned by Americans, but homemade cottage cheese and butter and buttermilk and home processed beef and chicken. And I mean, that was all legal back in the 60s and early 70s. You know, you could actually do this. And then we watched the erosion of those freedoms, which coincided with the amalgamation of the industrial industry. The regulations and the centralization of the food system, the regulations from the government and the centralization of the food system, you know, went hand in hand, coupled with the consumer convenience factor, where people started coming out of the kitchen and thinking, you know, kitchens are for
homemakers
for unsophisticates.
So how did you survive through this though? Because it seemed like during the consolidation, I mean, like we're talking thousands of farms went out of business and there was like the farm crisis and all these different things. I don't know much about the history, but it does seem like the consolidation of the food industry had a lot of political and financial, you know, nefarious backing behind it. So like, did you do something differently through this time or you just were able to adapt and stay small?
Yeah, well, the main thing that we did, first of all, we worked with nature's template. So we looked at, you know, what's the ancient horse that won this race? Well, it's not feedlots and it's not factory farms. It's animals actually moving, animals moving outdoors, animals moving outdoors on pasture. You know, you can layer these things on as you start looking at nature's template, and lots of different kinds of animals in the same pasture moving throughout the seasons. And so when you look at nature's template, if I could call it the horse that's been winning races for a long, long time, it's those templates that we began mimicking. Guess what? We don't buy chemicals. We don't buy chemical fertilizers. Mm-hmm. It takes less equipment. It takes less capital. It's less fragile. It's more resilient. We don't have vet bills. The animals are healthy. They have immune systems. And the diet makes them taste better. So there's a sales opportunity for people who care about what their food tastes like, handles like, and the nutritional components of it. So we began direct marketing and we built a customer base and a brand name and began becoming a final retailer.
Yeah. Was there a draw to industrialize, go big? Like, did you ever get approached? Were there opportunities? Like, were you watching other farmers get big, you know, do big operations and think, oh man, I want to do that? Or was it just like you always kind of thought differently?
Well, fortunately, you know, I have a legacy of thinking differently. My grandfather was a charter subscriber to Rodale's Organic Gardening and Farming magazine. And so, you know, my dad got that kind of, you know, ecological bent from him, and I got it from dad. And so, you know, we just had a real clear, true north belief base.
Yeah.
I can remember when I came back to the farm full time, starting out, dad was an accountant, but he never made a living from the farm, neither did mom, but their off-farm jobs paid for the land, which of course is a very common thing in startups. And so I can remember early on, you know, Teresa and I were living in the attic on $300 a month, driving a $50 car, TV, still don't have a TV. If we didn't grow it, we didn't eat it. We had our own firewood, so we had our own heat. And, you know, we were just living one time. I probably came home and was talking about the neighbor's big John Deere tractor or whatever. And he just looked at me and he said, I never knew who his clients were, who his accounts were, confidentiality. But he just would say, those big guys, he would say, we're actually financially more secure and resilient than they are. They're turning lots of money, but they're not keeping that much.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. I wanted to make the show practical for people. You hear a lot about, they say, get to know your farmer, right? But even myself, only the last few years, I started going to farmers markets. And then I met a local farmer in Austin who I get my grass-fed beef from, Bill. And I went out to his property a few times. But it's not a very obvious path to go from like never been to a farmers market and wanting to get to know my farmer. So like, what's some advice for people? And, you know, what are some questions to ask? How do you really get to know your farmer?
I mean, I can tell you right now, with the pandemic, we're actually encouraging our customers and people who aren't our customers to come to the farm just for recreation, for whatever, you know, entertainment. Let their kids play in the creek, build a dam in the creek, walk around the pond, watch the frogs jump in, you know, watch the dragonflies. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of just emotional satiation and balance in connecting to our ecological umbilical. And it's not a theme park, doesn't cost you anything. So I think the critical element here in connecting to your farmer is to want to do it or to see the need for it.
Yeah.
And as soon as you say, you know, I think I'd like to know where those potatoes came from, or I'd like to know where those eggs came from. As soon as you have an interest in that, the actual logistics of working it out are not that difficult. You know, you've got a carton, you've got a brand name on it, or, you know, you met somebody at farmer's market, you met a friend that told you about this farmer, and you just call them up, or you turn off Netflix and you head out yep. there, you know, you're not going to Disney World right now. So, you know, you've got time on your hands and just go out for a visit. So what are you looking for? Well, first of all, a good farm should be aesthetically and aromatically sensually romantic. Mm. You know, if you're walking around holding your nose saying, ooh, this stinks and it's ugly, it's probably not a good farm. And it's like that kind of vetting, that vetting skill is like any skill. And you'll be a novice at first, like you were when you were in kindergarten trying to learn how to read. But after you'd visit three or four, some commonalities start showing up. Is the farm welcoming? You know, here at our farm, we have a 24/7 open door policy, unannounced. Anyone can come from anywhere in the world, anytime, to see anything, anywhere, unannounced. That's our commitment to transparency. I've heard some people say, if you go to farmer's market and you buy from a farmer three times and that farmer doesn't invite you to the farm, they're probably not a very good farmer. That's like a litmus test.
Yeah.
So as you start to interact, you'll start getting intuition and hunches about, that guy seems trustworthy. Oh, that guy is kind of a smooth talker, but I'm not sure it's all what is crazy. You go visit. If you see a bunch of bare dirt, if you see a bunch of chickens out, you know, on bare ground, if it just looks unkempt, like a rat hole, it might be something that you want to have second thoughts about.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. So what's the point to all this? You know, like we tell people they should care about their food. They should probably get in the kitchen. They should do these things. And generally most people, they just want to feel good and they want to look good. Right. So what would you say to kind of connect that to talking about knowing your food, going on a farm, you know, to going beyond labels and to that end goal?
Yeah, well, that's right. People do want to feel good and look good. And so the obvious question is, well, what kind of fuel? I mean, we can use all sorts of metaphors. I mean, an interesting one is fuel in your car. If you want your car to feel good, you don't put a bunch of crappy, you know, gasoline in it. Mm-hmm. You want to put the good stuff. And the same thing is with your, you know, with your body. You want to put in the good stuff. Well, does it really make a difference? Yes, it does make a difference. I mean, we've participated in numerous empirical, you know, studies over the years. I can give you one with Mother Earth News, commissioned it about 8 years ago. We, along with 11 other farmers in the U.S., sent our eggs to a lab in, I think it was Oregon, and they checked for about 10, you know, different nutrients. One of them was folic acid, for example. It's really important for pregnant women. And the actual official USDA label on eggs says that they contain 48 micrograms of folic acid per egg. And our eggs average 1,038 micrograms per egg.
It's incredible.
We're not talking about 10% deviations here.
Yeah.
Grass-finished beef, for example, in general has 300% more riboflavin than grain-finished beef, than feedlot-finished beef. Well, what's the importance of riboflavin? Well, riboflavin is the calming essential fatty acid. It's what keeps you emotionally balanced. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, people like me that are in the business, you wonder, well, what makes kids, you know, shoot up kids at school? What makes road rage? What makes people go bonkers? They're not getting enough riboflavin.
Yep.
And, you know, conjugated linoleic acid. I mean, it only takes 2 weeks of grain feeding on an herbivore to shove the conjugated linoleic acid, CLA, out of their body. What's the importance of CLA? Well, CLA is what keeps the synapses flexible. So as you age, your synapses, where the nerve endings jump across, like little electric connections, those tend to get more brittle and more rigid over time, which then reduces the whip action and the performance of the synapses. And so, you know, CLA is very critical in that. I mean, the omega-3, omega-6 balance is critical as well. And the single biggest way to balance out omega-3, omega-6 is with salad, is with green material, high carotene diets. You have to realize that, you know, 98% of the food of the animals grown in this country are grown in high stress situations.
Yep.
Then this, you know, fecal particulate, which stimulates, you know, E. coli, salmonella, all these things. I think one of the most interesting things that we've actually learned, we service a lot of restaurants, about 50 of them. And one of the things that we've learned from our restaurants consistently, and this has just been going on for years and years, is that all of our meats cook about 20% faster than the industrial counterpart. Doesn't matter whether it's pork, beef, chicken, doesn't matter, 20% faster. Well, why is that? Well, there's a couple reasons, but I think the single biggest reason is because our animals are never stressed. In a industrial confinement factory farm situation, those animals are stressed every single day, 24/7, 365. Yep. Well, they don't live 365, but they're stressed every single day of their life. When you're stressed, you secrete adrenalines. Pick up a car from somebody when it tips on them. Adrenaline is what makes you be able to run faster when a bear is chasing you. Mm-hmm. And so stress creates this adrenaline, and adrenaline is not relaxing. It makes you more muscular. It's a
contract, right?
You know, it's a contraction thing that heightens your performance. It toughens your muscles, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so here we are raising these animals under 100% 24/7 stressful conditions. And is it any wonder that is A, going to cook longer, but B, intuitively, is it any wonder that kind of fuel for our bodies will bring a stress factor along with it into ourselves? I don't want to get all, you know, woo-woo and mystical on you, but you know, we say you are what you eat. You are what you eat eats.
Yes.
And so all of these nuances, from essential fatty acids to ratios of different vitamins and minerals, to the existence of the vitamins and minerals. I mean, look, our cow or our chicken or our pig out here in the pasture is eating as many as probably 20 different kinds of plants a day, 20 different kinds of plants a day, you know, from plantain to clover to fescue, I mean, forbs and all sorts of things. In Australia, the Aborigines are alleged to have eaten as many as 3,000 different kinds of food items. Americans eat what, you know, 30. And all you have to do is get a cookbook, get a Dolly Madison's cookbook or Martha Washington's cookbook from colonial America. And I'm not kidding. 75% of all the foods in there, we've never seen.
Yeah.
I mean, who eats currants, you know, currant bushes? I mean, those were common in early times. And so we just don't get that variety. But if you eat animals that are on pasture, you get a lot of that variety through the nuanced muscle that gets metabolized by that. And I mean, I don't know how many little beings of bacteria I have in my microbiome that really needs a little thread of plantain to survive. But there's probably a couple of them. And when I eat meat that's eaten plantain, I feed that bacteria. When we simplify everything, now knowing what we know about the gut and the brain relationship, is it any wonder that simplification through the system actually simplifies our brain to where we can't even think about complex things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, speaking of cooking and getting in the kitchen, right? I'm just curious, what do you do in your household? Do you guys have elaborate, you know, cooking techniques, or you keep it simple, you do one pot meals? Because I find this is a big sticking point for people, is they might go source quality food, they might get to know their farmer, but then, like, you know, maybe they get motivated to learn some cooking, whatever, they get in the kitchen a little bit, and then they just kind of regress to their mean. So do you have any tips for that?
Well, I'm not the cook in my family. You know, my wife is the ultimate cook here, but we're not gourmands. We're not gourmands right. by any means. I'll tell you this. When you get the real stuff, you don't need a bunch of sophisticated sauces and marinades and all that stuff.
Yep, so true.
I mean, we do a lot of crock pot. Of course, now there's the Instapot. But a lot of slow cooker crock pot cooking. I mean, that is the easiest. You just go out, you can get a frozen T-bone steak or a frozen piece of meat. You can throw it in there with some, you know, potatoes and carrots and onions and throw some salt and pepper in there. Go to work at 8 a.m. That thing just sits there and just kind of bubbles, you know, on 40 watts of power all day. And if you get home at 4, it's ready. If you get home at 5, it's ready. If you don't get home until 8, it's not overcooked. It's not dry. It's ready. And so we really think that the slow cooker / crock pot is absolutely the simplest, most trouble-free. It will guarantee you a good outcome. I mean, grilling, the other cooking techniques, a flame grill. I mean, there's some sophistication in that.
Definitely is.
So, you know, the slow cooker is a great technology of the 21st century.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So I got a couple of quotes out of the book that I want to ask you about. And then, mostly due to our connection problems, I want to let you get back to your day. We still got a lot of value out of this already. In the early parts of the book, you talk about silos. So experts talk about silos. Can you just expand on that a little bit? I thought that was a fascinating idea.
Yeah, well, so we've all heard about silos. What that means is that we live in our own silo. All of us are expert in our own little world. We're all myopic. And so it's really hard to look outside of the silo. And that's one of the reasons why Sina and I think the book is so valuable, is because, you know, she was living in this silo of chemistry and nutrition. I was living in this silo of farming, and so I've learned from her, she's learned from me, and so what we desperately need is cross-pollination and eclectic dialogues with people we wouldn't normally run around with in order to bring us a more comprehensive, balanced view of life.
Yep.
And so, so look, if you want to break out of your silo, that might be one of the best mental decisions that you can make.
Yeah. And that actually leads perfectly to the next thing that I highlighted when I was reading. So you said we live in victim land. Can you just expand on that a little bit?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Victim land. Yeah, we applaud victims anymore. I mean, the idea that I'm responsible, what? I'm responsible? No, my doctor's responsible for my health.
Yep.
Food? No, the supermarket's responsible for my food. Or the
government.
The McDonald's or whatever. Yeah, the government. Yeah. I mean, it goes the spectrum. And so the fact is that the only person that's going to actually take care of you is you. And if you become a victim of circumstance, say, well, you know, I can't because I don't earn enough or I don't have enough time. I just told you how you could cook in minutes with a slow cooker using high tech, you know, stuff that's very cheap. And so there are a lot of answers to cost of good food, to convenience of good food, to culinary expertise. There are answers all over the place, but you will never find the answers if you start with "I can't because I didn't grow up that way. I didn't learn that. I don't have enough time. I don't have enough money." You know, whatever your "I can't" is the precursor of being a victim, and you will never punch through that until you quit being a victim.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Okay, so what's something we didn't ask before we let you go? What's a question maybe related to the book or something you would just want people to kind of think about right now?
Well, one of the things I want people to think about right now is that with the pandemic, it's fundamentally changing buying habits. And for the first time, we're actually hearing people routinely ask, "Well, how do I build my immune system?" That's a great conversation to have. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want anybody to get sick, but again, being a victim, look, we're creating a society that says unless and until we have a vaccine, I'm a victim of this disease.
Yep.
No, look, I want somebody to push Dr. Fauci aside, the poor man, and say, here, America, we're going to give you a recipe for immune building for a week. Do this for 1 week. See if you don't feel better.
Yep.
So we're not going to drink any soft drinks. We're going to throw Coca-Cola away. We're not going to do any of that. We're not going to eat a McDonald's and fast food. We're going to eat food that we can pronounce for 1 week. Might mean you have to cook it. Might mean you have to, you know, do some things, but eat only food you can pronounce. And then we're going to get outside for 1 hour a day, and we're going to work up to 20 minutes a day of at least a mild sweat. We're going to get some exercise. We're going to move. All right. You know, Michelle Obama, we're going to let's move. All right. And then we're going to sleep for 8.5 hours a night. We're going to drink 2 quarts of water a day. And finally, well, I would say emotionally, if you listen to 10 minutes of news, then wash it away with 20 minutes of comedy. Get some Laurel and Hardy, I Love Lucy, something, you know, where you belly laugh for twice as long as you watch the depressing news. And finally, we're going to forgive everybody we hate. Everybody you hate, write them down and forgive them.
That's
good. And you do that recipe for 1 week, and the chances are you'll never get sick from COVID because your immune system will be so good, it'll just pass you by.
Yeah, that's great. It's surprising because everything you just said to do, you could probably do in about an hour a day if you condensed it. And maybe if you're cooking a couple of meals, you spread out, you know, hour and a half to 2 hours a day. But I mean, we're talking about then health that you're going to enjoy for the rest of your life. That's going to protect you. That's going to keep you out of the doctor, out of hospitals, not buying pharmaceuticals. It's just baffling to me at this point with the amount of information that's available that we still struggle just getting people to be like, okay, that's cool. I'm going to do that. It really is fascinating.
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating to me. When I drive down the road and there goes a tractor trailer carrying Coca-Cola and Mountain Dew. Here we are in a pandemic, fighting for our lives, fighting for our immunity systems. And those trucks are, look,
yep.
I don't have vengeance. I don't hate them, but I do hate what they do to our immune system.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got a guy, guzzling half a pound, a pound of sugar a day, because those sugary drinks have, tablespoons of sugar in each one. And then he's hoping he doesn't get sick, and he's hoping he doesn't fall victim to this thing. And he's hoping that there's a vaccine that'll fix whatever he gets, if he gets it. And it's just a very enslaved mindset that's dependent on a bunch of other people. And I'm saying what I've just described, it doesn't cost anything. All it does is enable you to own your own future. And I'd say that's an investment worth making.
Absolutely. Brian, you had a funny anecdote you wanted to ask about before we let him go.
There were two things when I was looking up different things that you'd done that I thought were hilarious. The first one was, apparently you would when somebody was talking about why GMOs might not be something you wanted, you had a quote about I think it was a rooster making love to a tomato.
Maybe he doesn't remember even.
Oh, no, I remember it well. So the point that, people ask, look, GMOs are just, they're just a new permutation of Mendel's peas, hybridization. No,
right.
Mendel's peas were peas having sex with peas. It wasn't a chicken on a tomato. If the sexual organs don't match up, it probably ain't right. And so to me, if you see a rooster getting along with a tomato in your garden, you'd probably think something's a little bit weird. And that's exactly what happens with genetically modified organisms, and why they are abridging all of the historical scientific boundaries to make sure that they abrogate every one of those boundaries. And the problem is, we humans, we're so clever, we can actually do things that we can't spiritually, emotionally, or physically metabolize.
Mm. Yeah, and we can't do the research to know the long-term implications in the extremely complex environments and how it can have downstream effects. And, someone like Nassim Taleb talks about that a lot, Fooled by Randomness. It just seems like when humans intervene in nature, we always screw it up. We're doing it the right way, but that's why we need regenerative agriculture, it seems like.
Yeah, that's right. And the other point of that is that the slinky effect of time is too short to be able to see what the ramifications. I mean, look, how long did the USDA and the FDA and the Dietetics Association tell Americans, you don't want to eat butter and lard. Man, you want hydrogenated vegetable oil. They did this for decades and decades and decades until now, all of a sudden, wham, not only should you eat less of it, you shouldn't eat any of it. So here a material that was promoted and encouraged and subsidized for decades has now suddenly become so bad it doesn't even exist anymore.
Yeah,
I mean, that's a profound, but look at how long that lag was. And there were people within 2 or 3 years screaming, saying, this is not right, we shouldn't be doing this. And they were lost in the orthodoxy, in the orthodox narrative for literally decades until that slinky finally caught up and we could connect the dots. And that's one of the big, one of the big problems is in real time, it takes time to see some of these things.
Yeah. I always think about 2100. What are humans, scientists, people going to look back and think about humans in 2020? I think they're just going to probably look at us as cavemen and our understanding of things.
Yeah, I think you're right. I do actually do a speech titled Heretics of the World Unite. And that's the whole idea. We look back at heresy. We look back at, when you think about, how Galileo was treated when he said, the Columbus, when the world was round. I mean, you look back and we laugh at ancestors who thought that the bubonic plague was spirit world and think back of all these things that we've seen. Women don't want to vote. And, the CEO of IBM in 1966 saying, there's no need for any more than 5 computers in the entire world. And you look back at this stuff and I'm with you. I love to go ahead and think, in 2100, what will our grandchildren be?
Exactly.
You know what they thought?
I know.
they believed the germ theory. They believed the germ theory.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So Joel, where can people find you and follow along?
Polyface Farms is our website. POLYFACE, Polyface Farms. And it's a website. You got a lot of information there. You'll enjoy just parking there for a few minutes.
Awesome. And we'll have a link to your new book and everything. And I believe you're shipping actually meat on the internet now. Is that true?
Yes, we are. So if you don't know where to find a farmer, or if you're confused and you're just wanting to dip your toe in the water, one of the things, so we're now shipping nationwide. You can get on the website, order from us, we'll send it in a box. And one of the things that this whole new world we're in creates is we've had literally a breakthrough in the pricing and the logistics of distribution. Mm-hmm. So it is becoming price competitive now with the more expensive, especially with the pandemic, social distancing and mask wearing requirements and just the whole physical bricks and mortar shopping experience. I don't know if it'll ever recover. And internet shopping carts are becoming easier and easier to navigate. It's all becoming easier. And so we're thankful that has enabled us to reach people that couldn't have been reached before. And yeah, we welcome any comers to come on and try something that's more like it was 1,000 years ago.
That's awesome. We'll have links to that below. And we really appreciate coming on the show and keep doing what you're doing. It matters.
Thank you guys. You've been delightful.
Please always remember that the members of the Ancestral Mind podcast are not, in fact, medical professionals. They're not doctors. They're not nutritionists. They are simply providing this entertainment for you to do your own research and to entertain yourselves. So please consult a physician before changing your diet. Not everything works for everybody. And make sure you always do your own research on everything you hear on this show and outside.